extraordinary presentation, an extraordinary one indeed. Thank you all so much for tuning in and supporting WBAI, this special presentation this morning. As I said, Gloria J. Brown Marshall, her program, Law of the Land, will be back next week. Please stay tuned. Coming up next over WBAI is Green Street with Patty and Doug Wood.
We depend on whistleblowers to keep governments honest and accountable, to make sure that pressure from outside parties doesn't subvert the primary purpose of government, which is to represent and protect the public interest. The pressure can be intense, especially with money on the line. It's hard to speak truth to power, to do the right thing, to stand up for your convictions, especially if doing so could cost you your job. You need thick skin, you need determination, and you need help. This is why we protect whistleblowers with special laws and incentives. This is why we help them remain steadfast in the face of anger, vitriol, and retribution. And this is Green Street.
Welcome to Green Street, the Environmental Health Show. Patty and Doug Wood and our network of scientists, public health and medical professionals, authors, engineers, activists, reporters, and others, all here on Green Street to help you understand a bit more of what is really going on around you, how it affects your health and safety, and how you can protect yourself and your family in this increasingly toxic world. Our show today is about doing the right thing, speaking truth to power, and standing up for what's right, even if it means risking your career. Kyla Bennett is one of our heroes, a woman of principle who refused to go along with industry's plans to build a massive facility in the middle of a bucolic and pristine natural area. Back in the 1990s, Kyla was a whistleblower at the EPA, and now she spends her time helping and advising other current and former government employees who have knowledge of corruption or wrongdoing in the places where they work. It's the kind of under-the-radar thing we don't always hear about, but is so vitally important to keeping our agencies and governments honest. So stay tuned for our interview with Kyla Bennett, coming right up after Patty in the Green Street News. What do you got for us today?
This first one is adapted from an article that was written by Matt Simon. This is especially important for people who have babies and young children. It was published in Wired, and the title is Baby Poop is Loaded with Microplastics. Whenever a plastic bag or a bottle degrades, it breaks into even smaller pieces that work their way into nooks in the environment. When you wash synthetic fabrics, tiny plastic fibers break loose and flow out to sea. When you drive, plastic bits fly off your tires and brakes. That's why literally everywhere scientists look, they're finding microplastics, specks of synthetic material that measure less than 5 millimeters long. They're on the most remote mountaintops and in the deepest oceans. They're blowing vast distances in the wind. In 11 protected areas in the western U.S., the equivalent of 120 million ground-up plastic bottles are falling out of the sky each year. And now microplastics are coming out of babies. One study describes sifting through infants' dirty diapers and finding an average of 36,000 nanograms of polyethylene terephthalate, or PET, P-E-T, per gram of feces, 10 times the amount they found in adult feces. They even found it in newborns' first feces. PET is an extremely common polymer that's known as polyester when it's used in clothing, and it is also used to make plastic bottles. The finding comes a year after another team of researchers calculated that preparing hot formula in plastic bottles severely erodes the material, which could dose babies with several million microplastic particles a day and perhaps nearly a billion each year. In addition to drinking from bottles, babies could be ingesting microplastics in a number of other ways. They have a habit of putting everything in their mouths, plastic toys of all kinds, but they also chew on fabrics. Microplastics that shed from synthetic textiles are known more specifically as microfibers, but they're plastic all the same. Babies' foods are wrapped in single-use plastic containers. Children drink from plastic sippy cups and eat off plastic plates. The carpets they crawl on are made of polyester. plastic. Even hardwood floors are coated in polymers that shed microplastics. Any of this could generate tiny particles that children breathe or swallow. Indoor dust is also emerging as a major route of microplastic exposure, especially for infants. Several studies of indoor spaces have shown that each day in a typical household, 10,000 microfibers might land on a single square meter of floor, having flown off clothing, couches, and bedsheets. Infants spend a significant amount of their time crawling through the stuff, agitating the settled fibers, and kicking them up into the air. What this means for human health, and more urgently for infant health, scientists are now racing to find out. Of particular concern are a class of chemicals called endocrine-disrupting chemicals, or EDCs, which disrupt hormones and have been connected to reproductive, neurological, and metabolic problems, for instance, increased obesity. While scientists know that EDCs are bad news, they don't yet know what level of microplastic exposure it would take to cause problems in the human body. Microplastics researchers say you can limit children's contact with particles. Do not prepare infant formula with hot water in a plastic bottle. Use a glass bottle. Vacuum and sweep to keep floors clear of microfibers. Avoid plastic wrappers and containers when possible. Microplastics have contaminated every aspect of our lives, so while you'll never get rid of them, you can at least try to reduce your family's exposure.
Well, it's a little gross, but really just horrifying, really.
And you know? Pretty horrifying. I mean, we know that we're breathing microplastics. We know that microplastics are in our water. We know that microplastics are in a lot of our foods, especially fish, right? Because there's so many plastics in the oceans that break down and break down and break down into these microplastics. And we're actually finding, you know, microplastics in the flesh of fish. Hence my program that I've been doing for 20 years called I'll Have the Plastic Fish Special. It's a real thing.
It's a real thing.
It always
was
a real thing.
Yeah. Okay. All right. What else you got?
Okay. This is an op-ed from Environmental Health News written by Seth Mullendore, and it is entitled, We Don't Have Time for Another Fossil Fuel Bridge. In his 2014 State of the Union address, President Obama praised natural gas as the bridge fuel that can power our economy with less of the carbon pollution that causes climate change. Switching from coal to gas was a key pillar of Obama's clean power plan to reduce climate emissions, which big environmental groups lined up to praise and fight for. We now know that methane, the primary component of natural gas, is a much more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. We know that gas plants are, at best, no more than a marginal improvement over coal. Today, wind and solar are the cheapest sources of new energy generation. The fight has largely shifted from coal to gas. Some energy companies and utilities still hold up gas as a bridge to enable more renewables, filling in the gaps when the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine. Others, including the oil and gas industry, the Biden administration, and inexplicably, many big green groups, are laying the foundation for a new bridge, touting the climate benefits of two dubious strategies, carbon capture, utilization and storage, and hydrogen. Many of the voices holding up carbon capture and hydrogen as new climate solutions are the same voices that fought for the natural gas bridge a decade ago. And once again, they're leading us down the wrong path, building a bridge to decades of additional emissions when we're rapidly running out of time to avoid the most dire impacts of climate change. As the latest report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, made abundantly clear, we don't have time for another fossil fuel bridge. Carbon capture, utilization, and storage involves removing carbon dioxide from the air, either at the source of production like a power plant or pulled directly from the air around us, and either using it for some other purpose or storing it underground, ideally forever. More than one watchdog group has described carbon capture as a boondoggle, and for good reason. The federal government has pumped billions into failed carbon capture projects, and the new infrastructure plan and reconciliation process is poised to inject tens of billions more. One after another, these projects have experienced delays and cost overruns, missed emission reduction targets, and ultimately failed. The few successful carbon capture projects still operating largely use captured carbon for enhanced oil recovery processes and get paid for the alleged climate benefit of burying CO2. Carbon capture is an expensive and energy-intensive process. Even when successful, carbon capture at power plants and industrial facilities will never eliminate all CO2 emissions released at the sites. Additionally, carbon capture does nothing to address the emission of harmful co-pollutants like nitrogen oxides or upstream emissions due to methane leakage in the extraction and transportation of natural gas. In fact, because carbon capture requires more fossil fuels to generate the same amount of energy, it exacerbates both of these issues. Hydrogen presents another emissions-laden path forward. Today, around 99% of hydrogen is produced through fossil fuel-intensive processes, resulting in gray hydrogen or, when paired with carbon capture, blue hydrogen. The only emissions-free way to generate hydrogen is through electrolysis of water powered directly by renewable energy. It's a classic bait and switch, delaying climate action and locking in decades of additional greenhouse gas emissions and continued air pollution. The best climate strategy we have is to fully commit to the rapid scale-up of solutions that we already know will work: solar, wind, hydro, geothermal, battery storage, energy efficiency, demand management. We already have the tools to realize deep decarbonization. It is not the time to dump billions of dollars into another fossil fuel bridge to nowhere.
Yeah, well said. This is the fossil fuel industry just trying to stay alive. It's in the dying phase, and it's, you know, struggling, you know, for life.
And these are their two options, as we heard from Sandra Steingraber, you
that's
know,
right.
yeah,
True.
In one of our
ago.
Shows,
yeah.
that this is where the fossil fuel industry is going to stay alive. Number one, carbon capture, and number two, plastics.
I didn't realize hydrogen was such required so much fossil fuel to create.
Unbelievable.
So, oh, man.
Yeah.
Okay.
So here's another article that's so important. And the plastics article that I read about, the microplastic, that's a fossil fuel product, right?
Right.
It's a fossil fuel product. And then I just read this one about this ridiculous new, you know, bridge to nowhere.
Yep.
And so, and now I'm going to read you about how climate change is impacting wine country in California. This is adapted from an article by Christopher Flavel from the New York Times, and it is entitled Scorched, Parched, and Now Uninsurable: Climate Change Hits Wine Country. In Napa Valley, the lush heartland of America's high-end wine industry, climate change is spelling calamity. Not outwardly. Tourists still stream into St. Helena's wineries with their exquisitely appointed tasting rooms. But drive off the main road, and the vineyards that made this valley famous, where the mix of soil, temperature patterns, and rainfall used to be just right, are now surrounded by burned-out landscapes, dwindling water supplies, and increasingly nervous winemakers bracing for things to get worse. Desperation has pushed some growers to spray sunscreen on grapes to try to prevent roasting, while others are irrigating with treated wastewater from toilets and sinks because the reservoirs are dry. Their fate matters even for those who can't tell a Merlot from a Malbec. What winemakers call smoke taint now menaces Napa's wine industry. Fires need not be close to wineries to cause trouble. Smoke from distant fires can waft long distances, and there is no way a grower can prevent it. Smoke is a threat primarily to reds, whose skins provide the wine's color. The skins of white grapes, by contrast, are discarded, and with them the smoke residue. Reds must also stay on the vine longer, often into October, leaving them more exposed to fires that usually peak in early fall. Vintners could switch from red grapes to white, but that solution collides with the demands of the market. White grapes from Napa typically sell for around $2,750 per ton on average. Reds, by contrast, fetch an average about $5,000 per ton in the valley. The losses have been stunning. Among the casualties were Stu Smith, whose entire crop was affected. Now the most visible legacy of the fire is the trees. The flames scorched not just the madrones that gave Mr. Smith's winery its name, but also the Douglas firs, the tan oaks, and the bay trees. Trees burned by wildfires don't die immediately. Some linger for years. One afternoon in June, Mr. Smith surveyed the damage to his forest, stopping at a madrone he especially liked, but whose odds weren't good. Quote, "It's dead," Mr. Smith said. "It just doesn't know it yet." There are other problems. Another grower pointed to his vineyards where workers were cutting grapes from the vines, not because they were ready to harvest, but because there wasn't enough water to keep them growing. He estimated it would reduce his crop this year by a third. "We don't have the luxury of giving them the normal amount that it would take them to be really healthy," he said. The pair of reservoirs that used to feed his vineyards tell the story. The first was one-third full. The other just above it had become a barren pit. So vintners are finding other solutions. 8 times a day, Joe Brown pulls into a loading dock at the Napa Sanitation District's facility, fills a tanker truck with 3,500 gallons of treated wastewater, and drives 10 miles to the vineyard, then turns around and does it again. The water, which comes from household toilets and drains, is sifted, filtered, and disinfected, is a bargain at $6.76 a truckload. The problem is transportation. Each load costs $140 to transport, adding to the cost of operations. And it may only be temporary. As the drought worsens, the city may decide its residents need the water more, and that source of water could dry up, too.
Okay, so we're putting sunscreen on grapes, and we're irrigating them with toilet water.
That's correct.
This is the state of winemaking in California, thanks to climate change.
That's correct. I mean, they're pretty desperate. I mean, it's a huge industry.
Yeah.
Huge industry in California.
Sure is. Yeah.
And it's going to go. There's no question it's going to go. I mean, we're not going to stop these wildfires.
Boy, a couple
They're going to last. They're going to start earlier and last longer every single year. And, you know, the smoke taint, I didn't know about that. I mean, I knew that smoke had to have some impact. But,
sure.
You know, they call it smoke taint. I had no idea that you kept the
skins on the red.
Yeah, I mean,
red
you can
grapes.
Tell how much I drink wine and how much I know about it, right? But anyway,
it's okay.
It's fascinating.
Yeah,
it's not going to get better. That's what all of us have to realize. This isn't going to get better.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Patty.
You're welcome.
It can be hard to speak truth to power, to blow the whistle on your boss or your agency or your government, especially if it means losing your job. It takes guts, courage, and a determination to stand up for what's right. Not everyone can do it, but Kyla Bennett is one of those people who can. And 25 years ago, she did. Now Kyla is the New England Director of PEER, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, the nonprofit organization that helps public employees who seek a higher standard of environmental ethics and scientific integrity within their agencies, often called whistleblowers. Patty and I spoke with Kyla last week about the current state of government, how she became involved in helping whistleblowers like herself, and what the future looks like from her perspective. Here's our interview with Kyla Bennett.
I started working at EPA in 1990, a long time ago. I worked in Region 1, which is the Boston region, so it covers all of New England. And I was doing wetlands permitting for New England, and eventually I took over the wetlands enforcement program. But Maine was my state that I was in charge of, and there was a proposal to take the largest uninhabited island off the coast of Maine, an island called Sears Island, and turn it into a cargo port. And it's funny because when I was in law school, one of the biggest cases that we learned about for NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, was about Sears Island. And then I inherited the case. So I was pretty excited that I had this famous case that I was dealing with. But the bottom line is that the state of Maine, Department of Transportation, wanted to put this cargo port there. And the island is really spectacular with incredible wetland resources, both coastal and freshwater. And it just simply did not comply with the regulations under the Clean Water Act. And I told the regional administrator of EPA at the time that a permit could not issue for this project because it would cause or contribute to significant degradation of waters of the U.S., which is the legal standard. And this was under the Clinton administration. And the regional administrator said to me, I don't care. Figure out a way to make this permit issue. And I refused. And he said to me, if you don't, I will take you off the case and put someone else on it who will. So I found PEER and called them up. And they represented me. We filed a complaint with the Department of Labor, and immediately EPA capitulated, gave me my job back in charge of that permit. The permit was eventually denied. The island is still undeveloped. It's still a fight. They're still trying to put something there, but it's still undeveloped. And that's how I got to know Pier. And after I stayed at Pier, I mean, stayed at the EPA for years after I was a whistleblower myself. I was a whistleblower in 1994, and I left in 1999, thinking that maybe I could do more good from the outside than the inside. And I've been working for Pier for more than 20 years now.
Wow. So just for our listeners, could you actually just identify what PEER is? What does it stand for?
Sure. Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. We're a national nonpartisan nonprofit based right outside of Washington, D.C. We have field offices around the country, and we support and defend local, state, and federal employees who work in the environmental or health arena. So basically, we're a whistleblower organization. We help whistleblowers try to solve the underlying environmental issue. We try everything we can to not get our clients fired or in trouble, but we try to fix the environmental problem so that they can stay there. Sometimes, unfortunately, that's not possible, and we do defend them when they get reprimanded, demoted, or fired.
Wow. I would imagine that you became busier during the Trump administration. Would that be fair to say, or am I jumping to conclusions here?
No, it's very fair to say. It's funny because prior to the Trump administration, I was always busier, believe it or not, under Democratic administrations. Hmm. And I'm not exactly sure why. I think Democrats really always try to find those win-win solutions that don't exist, maybe. I'm not sure. But the Trump administration was far and beyond the worst, that we were so busy, so busy. And unfortunately, we're still really busy. First of all, because the Biden administration is a little bit slow to clean up the mess that Trump left.
Right.
And a lot of the, as evidenced by our EPA whistleblowers that we're going to talk about today, some of the mid-level managers who aren't political appointees are really problematic, and they're still at the agency.
Hmm.
Okay, so let's talk about the agency. You know, having worked there for a while, you probably have a good handle on the history of the EPA. And, how we got to this point where it is no longer doing what it was originally intended to do.
Yeah, it's actually horrifying to me. Someone once asked me, does EPA need to get raised and then rebuilt? And I don't think so. I think it's kind of like an old house that needs to be gutted and then built back from the inside. The structure is right. The laws are actually quite powerful if they're implemented correctly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The problem is the culture has become one of, trying to assist industry rather than protect human health and the environment. And what the Biden administration really needs to do, in my opinion, is to clean house. They need to get rid of some of these entrenched managers who think it's their job to waive studies for the industry, save the industry money, get chemicals out as quickly as they can onto market. That's not what EPA's mission is. EPA's mission is to protect human health and the environment, and they've lost that.
Did that happen over time, Kyla? Is this something that's been occurring over a long period of time, or is it relatively sudden?
I think it's been happening over a long, long time. And I try to really stress to people that this is not just a Trump problem. A lot of these environmental nonprofits, including PEER, we got what we call a Trump bump. When Trump was elected, people gave us money thinking, oh God, this is going to be awful. You have to do something. But honestly, it's been bad for a long, long time. EPA has been, I think when it first started, people were like, oh, big bad EPA, and they were doing the right thing. And gradually industry learned how to infiltrate the agency. There's an incredible revolving door in the Office of Chemical Safety and Pollution Prevention. There was one manager who's gone back and forth between EPA and the very industries that he regulated four times now, just keeps going back and forth. And that should not be happening. We should not be allowing that.
So, we hear about this and not just the EPA, but also the FDA and the FCC and, all of these agencies that were set up to regulate industries for protecting public health. And that's not happened. But can you explain a little bit, how it works within the agency between the management and the scientists?
Sure, I can try. I can tell you the way it should work. I can also
tell you the
way it is working. You know, it's funny because when I was at EPA back in the 90s, my managers didn't always know anything about wetlands. They didn't know about the subject matter that we were working on. Mm-hmm. And they believed that managers just had to understand management and that they could manage anything. I don't agree with that. I think that managers really need to have a good grasp of the subject matter. I was very lucky when I was at EPA because my immediate supervisor knew wetlands very well and was great at supporting me and my decisions and everyone else in our section. But the way it's working now is in OCSPP, the Office of Chemical Safety and Pollution Prevention, which is where our whistleblowers are from, most of the managers are PhD scientists. They're not experts in everything. You can't be. EPA does need to significantly increase the number and type of scientists that they have in this division. They are really short on brain power there. For example, they need somebody who's an expert in cancer. They need an inhalation expert in organic chemistry. They need all of these expertise. It's kind of like when you know, if you have a problem with your knee, you're not going to go to a dermatologist. Similarly, at EPA, you need all these different scientists with expertise in different areas in order to do proper risk assessments, and they don't have that. But the managers, even though they are scientists in this division, they've just lost sight of what's important, and the bean counting is driving their decision making. So in other words, they are actually, their performance is evaluated based on the number of chemicals they get out on market, not on the number of chemicals that they're preventing from getting out on market and harming people. I mean, it's totally backwards.
Wow.
So I think the way it should work is that science should rule. I mean, everything EPA does should be based on science. It must be based on science, and it must be based on relevant science that's not industry based. So much of the science that EPA looks at is industry science that they've done themselves, and it's skewed. You know, science can be skewed, and they need to look at independent science. The career scientists who are there are, for the most part, competent, brilliant, and they really know what they're doing, and they want to do the right thing. You don't go to EPA to make a fortune or to get famous. You go to EPA because you care about the environment. But some of these managers are going to EPA, rising up in the ranks, and then getting cozy with industry so that they can get a job with industry after they get out. And they're not listening to the scientists. They're overturning their decisions. And that's just wrong and shouldn't be happening.
You're listening to Green Street, the Environmental Health Show with Patty and Doug Wood. And our guest today is Kyla Bennett, the New England Director of PEER, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, the nonprofit organization that helps public employees blow the whistle on local, state, and federal governments and agencies that are going down the wrong path.
So that seems like it would be a simple fix if you're saying that they're only looking at industry, you know, funded science. I mean, independent science is out there, that academic peer-reviewed stuff that's funded by organizations, foundations, or it's hard. I'm about to say universities, but many of the universities are funded by the industry. So
right.
It's really tough, but it does exist. So, I mean, who determines what science they're looking at? It seems odd that they're only looking at industry funded science. Who's making that decision?
Well, Patty, unfortunately, there's not as much science out there for these new chemicals as you would think. And
right.
most people think that when EPA does a risk assessment, you know, they picture these EPA scientists in white lab coats in a lab, you know, with goggles and test tubes. And that's not how it works. For these new chemicals, and that's what our disclosures were about, this new chemicals division, sometimes these risk assessors are given nothing more than the name of the chemical and one abstract of an industry-run study. That's the only information they're given. And they have to do a risk assessment on that chemical within 90 days. That 90 days is a statutory deadline. Now, they do have the ability in the law to reset that clock, to say to the industry, I'm sorry, we simply don't have enough data here to make a determination on whether this chemical is going to pose a risk to human health or the environment, and you need to provide us with that information. And then the clock is reset and starts again once they get that information, but managers are not allowing them to invoke that. So they have this 90-day deadline with virtually no information. And so what they have to do is, remember, these are new chemicals, so they're not studied. Sometimes these are chemicals that have just been developed by these companies. A lot of them are confidential business information, so nobody has studied them or even knows anything about them. And so what the EPA risk assessors have to do is they have to look for what we call an analog, which is a chemical that will behave very similarly to the new chemical. And then they have to kind of extrapolate and say, okay, well, this new chemical is very similar to this chemical A that we know about. And this one has this toxicity. So therefore, this new chemical probably has that toxicity too. So it's not as straightforward as we would hope that it would be. Sure. And it's kind of scary when you think about how little information these risk assessors have before these new chemicals go out on the market. Right. It's made me lose sleep.
Right. And, you know, and these are chemicals that, of course, you know, that children, you know, all of us, but especially children are being exposed to. They're being used in, you know, consumer products, or they're being used on food, you know, in the agricultural sector. So I find it amazing that we, you know, we go, you know, decades and we've only looked at five chemicals when they were up for, you know, re-registration or whatever it is that they do. And they spend enormous amounts of time going back and forth and back and forth on a particular chemical, one chemical. And then they decide, nope, they're not going to ban it.
It's you hit the nail on the head, Patty. That is one of the huge problems. And EPA is allowed to regulate chemicals in classes. And indeed, they do regulate some as classes. And one example that we're really pushing hard, and we're actually working with Arlene and Green Science Policy. They're a great outfit.
Yeah.
But are the PFAS chemicals, the per and polyfluoroalkyl substances that everyone, it's on the front page of every newspaper everywhere. It's really a national crisis. According to EPA's CompTox database, there are 9,252 of these chemicals, and we're playing whack-a-mole with them. They're trying to regulate them one at a time. Here in Massachusetts, where I am, the state regulates six out of 9,252. And we're pushing EPA to try to get them to regulate them as a class, because even though they are somewhat diverse, they're all extremely persistent. The ones that we've studied are toxic. Most of the ones that we've studied bioaccumulate. And the persistence is a real problem. That carbon fluorine bond in PFAS, we cannot break it. We don't know how to destroy it. EPA even put out a kind of like a reward, a $50,000 reward for anybody who could figure out how to destroy PFAS. Yeah.
Wow.
So,
wow. Okay.
So we really do need to regulate as a class.
Okay.
Yep.
So this is a class of chemicals that have a lot of use in different manufacturing processes and you know, products and so on, like firefighting chemicals. So does PEER represent the firefighters?
And, oh, yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes, we do.
Just take that one instance and tell me how PEER is operating with the firefighting foam that contains these high levels of PFAS.
Sure. We're actually not working on the foam issue, which is recognized, and people are indeed trying to get rid of AFFF foam, the fluorinated foam, and there are alternatives out there. However, our firefighter clients, and we have a number of them around the country, are getting cancer from their turnout gear, the jackets and the pants that they're
clothing.
Gear, that turnout gear is what they call it, has parts per billion of a number of PFAS chemicals in it. And remember that we measure this in our water in parts per trillion, and California is trying to regulate one PFAS in the parts per quadrillion. So it's toxic at very low levels. I have one client on Nantucket. He's a firefighter. He was diagnosed with testicular cancer at age 38. And he's in remission right now. He had surgery and the whole thing, and he's back on the island. And he said to me that every time he goes to work and has to put that same gear on that gave him the cancer, it just kills him. Can you imagine how awful that must be? So what PEER has been working with the firefighters to, it's such a complicated issue, but basically there's a nonprofit called the National Fire Protection Association, the NFPA. Mm-hmm. Yep. They're in Massachusetts. They are the standard setting agency, and they have this unnecessary light degradation test. The turnout gear has got three layers. It's got an outer layer, a middle moisture barrier, and then a thermal liner. It's that middle moisture barrier that has the PFAS in it. Mm-hmm. And NFPA's regulations require PFAS to be in that gear. And guess who's sitting on those technical committees? Mm-hmm. Of NFPA are these manufacturers, the PFAS manufacturers. Industry has its tentacles in our unions, in these standard setting agencies, in our government, and in our government agencies. And it's horrifying. We did an emergency amendment to the NFPA. We helped the firefighters do it, and we failed. We're helping them appeal that decision. We've got our last appeal. We've appealed. This will be our second appeal. And then we're going to look at possible legal remedies, because until NFPA changes that standard, the companies, the manufacturers can't even make PFAS-free turnout gear. And we've got clients who are infertile, male infertility. We've got clients with cancer. We've got clients dying. In 2019, 75% of online firefighter duty deaths were due to cancer. 75%. And yeah, this is not from the stuff they're breathing. They've got a lot of time when they're going into these bad situations, they've got breathing apparatus. You know, this is from their gear. It's mm-hmm. from the gear that we're making them wear, and it's just despicable.
So who's come up with some alternatives? I'm as you're talking, I'm thinking, how about wool? How about, you know, treated wool with lanolin or something, you know, as that side layer? I mean, it's fire retardant. It's moisture and, you know, and stain resistant, whatever. I don't know. I mean, nobody wants to do that. The chemical manufacturers are making so much money. They get themselves into every single industry, every single product that's being manufactured, and, you know, promote the, you know, the benefits of using that chemical or inserting that chemical into their manufacturing process. And here we are. We're just all the, you know, we're just the recipients of all of this. Our children, our, you know, our environment even. I mean, PFAS has an impact on the environment, not just on people.
It has, I don't know if you saw the recent news that came out, but it's got a huge impact on climate change.
Oh, yeah.
It's a really good analogy when you think about PFAS, because it's so persistent and because it's called the forever chemical, after all, we can't break that bond. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like climate change. If we stopped burning things, if we stopped burning fossil fuels tomorrow, the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is going to stay at about, what is it now, 412, 415 parts per million. It'll stay there. It'll take centuries before it starts going down. It just won't increase anymore, which is what we need to do. Same thing with PFAS. If we stop using PFAS right now, we're still going to have all that contamination in our environment, and it'll take decades, hundreds of years before it starts going down. But we need to take that first step, because the more we put into the environment, the longer it's going to last and the more it's going to impact us.
The more harm it's going to do. I mean, we are... You know, I teach this class to kindergarten and first graders. It's called Gifts from the Earth. And I have these three big jars. And, you know, one jar has nothing in it. And they guess pretty quickly that that's air. And then one other one has water in it. And the other one has soil. And I say, these are three life-giving gifts that the earth gives to us. Okay, life-sustaining gifts. We can't live without them. Why? Because we need to breathe, we need to drink, and we need to grow our food, blah, blah, blah. And then we talk about how we pollute it, you know, and the kids really, really get it. And I say, you know what, we are supposedly the, you know, the highest intellectual form of life, right? And yet we are the only life form that destroys our own life-giving resources. We're destroying, you know, what we need to survive.
And I really don't understand it, because when you know, fighting with these chemical companies, what are they thinking? Don't they have children and grandchildren? Don't they? They can't buy their way out of this. You know, you hear about all these billionaires who are building these underground bunkers in New Zealand, and they're going to go underground for a few years. When they come out, what's going to be left for them? I mean, I don't understand what their thinking is.
Well, they're thinking they can always get bottled water, and they can just, you know, go out to sea on their yacht.
Well, to be fair, I think a lot of them have drunk the Kool-Aid, the corporate Kool-Aid, which says, you know, these fears are overblown. You know, we're a great society. We can figure our way out of things. We can always invent new products and new things that can undo some of what we're doing now. So don't worry about it. Besides, we have quarterly earnings to report next week, and that's what's really important, and that's what your job depends on. So I'm curious, Kyle, you mentioned this $50,000 prize for anybody that could break the bond. Did you get any takers? Did you get is there anything on the horizon?
Yeah, somebody did win it. I don't remember who it was, but you know, the thing is, so often I get these emails from people saying, look, somebody's figured out how to break down PFAS, and it, you know, sometimes you can get it to work on the bench, as we call it, you know, in the lab.
In the lab, right.
But you can't, it doesn't translate to the larger. I mean, when you think about, I read a statistic somewhere that said that, you know, some of these factories are dumping something like 8 tractor trailer trucks full of PFAS contaminated water every day from their factories. Where are you going to store all that until we can figure out how to break it? But it's people are working really hard on it, but there's nothing that I know of on the horizon that's promising right now.
So if you were going to put together a recipe for how to fix the problem, where would you start, and what would that recipe look like? Does that start with government agencies like the EPA?
Absolutely. Absolutely, it starts. I mean, if EPA were allowed to function as it was originally intended, I think that we could make a lot of headway. A reporter once asked me, you know, when was the heyday for EPA? And I said, probably the Nixon years. I mean, it's literally been that long since EPA has operated the way it should. I think the solution, if I were leader of the free world, I would get corporations would not be people. I would get corporate money out of government, full stop. You know, Congress people should not be allowed to be trading stocks. They should not, you know, look at all the insider trading that's going on. And we can't afford to have these industry have free access to our government agencies. These clients, these whistleblowers are saying, you know, you walk into prior to COVID, when you walked into EPA's lobby, there are industry people there who run up to you and say, oh, what a pretty dress you have on today. How are you doing? You know, and taking them on crop tours and giving them barbecues and trying to, you know, win them over. So, you know, and these are the scientists, these are the staff scientists, the managers, they have each other's cell phone numbers. We did a FOIA, a Freedom of Information Act request for the government phone records for one manager in the Office of Chemical Safety and Pollution Prevention. And EPA gave us everything, redacted every single phone number from his government phone. And it was like, that's first of all wrong. We're appealing it, but they won't even tell us. There's such secrecy and such a close relationship between industry and the EPA that has to be stopped. It just has to be stopped, and it can be stopped. And I'm, you know, at first, when the Biden administration came on, we were all cautiously optimistic, but I'm starting to get really frustrated at their inaction. They release, especially surrounding our whistleblowers at EPA, they release these strong statements saying, we take this very seriously. We will not tolerate retaliation against these people. We're going to get to the bottom of it. But aside from the IG, which is evaluating everything, and the inspector general is actually, from what I can tell, doing a phenomenal job investigating or evaluating our allegations. But the rest of EPA is doing nothing, and it's going on unabated. These things are still happening. Chemicals are going out on the market on a daily basis that have improper risk assessments that have the potential to harm not only workers, but the fence line communities and the general population. And it's despicable.
Fence line communities are communities that are in close proximity to these manufacturing plants that are highly polluting, correct?
Correct. And they're usually minority communities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you'd think that Michael Regan, the administrator of EPA, who has such a strong environmental justice bent, and I'm thrilled for that, you'd think he would care. Mm-hmm. But we've heard nothing from him. We've written to him. We've heard nothing.
So So has anybody put together a blueprint for how to do this major overhaul, this major fix at EPA? And I mean, does that exist? And if it does, does every single legislative office in Washington have a copy of it?
And so that's a good question. And Dr. Richard Dennison from the Environmental Defense Fund, who has devoted the past 30 plus years of his life to fixing the TSCA program, the Toxic Substances mm-hmm. Control Act, which is mm-hmm. the one that we're talking about. He has a blueprint of how to fix it. That's wonderful. And it's on his website. We had a webinar earlier this week where he spelled it out. We try to tell EPA, for example, PUR is weighing in very heavily on, EPA is trying to fix, quote unquote, their scientific integrity policy and office. And it's a mess. It doesn't work. It's a, as we say, a beacon of false hope for those employees. In fact, our clients, our EPA clients, tried to go through the scientific integrity policy and fix things internally. They finally came to us because they weren't getting any traction. Nothing is happening under that scientific integrity policy. There's no good process to fix these problems. So yes, we do have answers, and they're not difficult answers. They don't even involve new laws or new regulations. They're not statutory fixes. They're cultural fixes and policy fixes and personnel fixes, right. And EPA isn't doing it.
And these are not unfunded mandates, right? I mean, these are simple things that that are not going to cost the government any money. It's just doing the right thing.
Correct.
So let me ask you about, in the European Union, I understand the precautionary principle is really beginning to get some traction in a way that it hasn't here. Why is that? And do you see a future for the precautionary principle to become a kind of founding principle at EPA and other agencies?
Doug, that's a great question. And I so wish that it would get traction. I was just told earlier this week by, I'm not going to throw anyone under the bus, but another nonprofit that's very well regarded, who told me that I should stay away from the language using the precautionary principle because it has become a bad word here in the US, So I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. You know, the difference between the EU and the US and a lot of other countries like Japan, here in the US, we basically act as if a chemical is innocent until proven guilty. And in the rest of the world, it's guilty until proven innocent. And that's the way it should be.
Right.
Honestly, it should be the industry should be, it should be incumbent on the industry to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that their chemical is not going to cause harm to public health or the environment. And that's not the way it works.
Yeah. So that's interesting. I also have another thought about why these other countries embrace the precautionary principle, and they're much, much more reticent to allow these chemicals on the market when there is science showing that they can cause harm. And my thought is that, yeah, but these other countries have socialized medicine also. So those governments are paying for all of the harm that it can do, right? All of the cancers and the reproductive effects and the neurological impacts and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas here, and this is really, interesting, but, sick people is good business.
That's a good point, Patty. It's possible that that's what it is. But the precautionary principle, and for your listeners, if they don't know what that is just basically saying that we need to err on the side of caution when there are a lot of unknowns, particularly when it's a matter of public health. So even though, for example, we don't know the toxicity of all the 9,252 PFAS chemicals, it's still okay to treat them as a class and be very cautious with them, because our suspicion is that the vast majority, if not all of them, are bad. So I wish we could use that. I don't think EPA is headed that way soon. And, frankly, our government is such a mess right now. I'm not sure what's going to happen to the EPA. I don't know if it's going to be fixed under the Biden administration. It scares me.
Mm. Yeah, it scares us, too. I mean, we were all, when the election happened and Trump's, Trump walked out the door, we were like, OK, now everybody's going to come back to the EPA. We're going to re-energize the thing, and we're going to finally be able to do what it's supposed to do. But you're not giving me a lot of encouragement that that's ever going to happen, given our current situation.
Well, let me give you an example. So under TSCA, as I was telling you earlier, they have this 90-day statutory deadline to assess these new chemicals and make a decision. And by the way, EPA has not denied any from 2016 to 2021. Zero. The statistics are on their website. They've let them all out. Some have been withdrawn, but all of them have been put out on market. But they have this 90-day statutory deadline. And in the budget from last year, the goal was to get 80% of chemicals out within this 90-day deadline. The Biden administration, under the fiscal year 22 EPA budget, it's moved that up to 100% to get out every single chemical within 90 days. So it's gotten worse in some respects under the Biden administration. And I don't, you know, I just don't think that the Biden administration fully understands the depth of the corruption at this agency or how to deal with it. I think that's the problem. And Pierre is here saying, we can help you between our whistleblowers and our knowledge of the inner workings of this agency. We can help you figure out how to fix it. And they're not taking us up on it at all.
So, Kyla, where do people find out more about Pierre? I mean, we're getting to the end of our time here. I also wanted to ask you if there was anything that we haven't talked about that you wanted to cover.
You can find Pierre at www.pierre.org. We are also on Facebook. We're on Twitter. And we are on Instagram as well. And we have a YouTube channel that has a lot of our webinars. So anybody can find us under YouTube. We're on Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. The only other thing that I'd like to mention is that these whistleblowers that Pierre has that have come forward from EPA, and we've got six or more right now in this division, they are heroes as far as I'm concerned. They're courageous. They're not doing this for, you know, recognition or fame or anything other than they are afraid for the American public because of what they see. And the scariest thing of all is that so many of these chemicals are cloaked under confidential business information. Even when I work with these employees, I don't know what chemicals we're talking about because it's considered confidential business information and no one's allowed to know except for a handful of people at the EPA. We don't know what they are. And so my clients are telling me how very toxic some of these things are. One drop on your skin, if you're pregnant, will lead to developmental problems with your fetus. You know, awful, awful chemicals. And the American public simply doesn't know. These clients can't sleep at night knowing that these chemicals are going out on the market. I can't sleep at night because of what they've told me. We need to do something. Everybody needs to contact their legislators and say, please have a hearing. Please let these whistleblowers say what's going on, and we need to fix this because it's frightening for everybody.
You've been listening to Green Street, the Environmental Health Show with Patty and Doug Wood. Our guest today has been Kyla Bennett, the New England Director of PEER, Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, the nonprofit organization that helps public employees blow the whistle on local, state, and federal governments and agencies that are going down the wrong path. Right now, it's time to take a look at the Green Street Inbox, which is our segment when Patty answers questions from listeners about common environmental issues around the house. We had an interesting email this week from a listener in Florida. She writes, I understand there are plastic fibers in the air and the water and even in the fish we eat. I have a young daughter. Where are these fibers coming from? And what can I do myself to reduce the amount of plastic fibers my family may be contributing?
Okay, I'm really glad that you're concerned about this because we should all be concerned about this. One of the biggest contributors to plastics in our environment is synthetic clothing. That and it's not just clothing, but also carpeting and drapery, you know, curtains and that kind of thing. Synthetic fabrics, when we wash them in the washing machine, literally shed millions of little microfibers into the rinse water, and that goes out into the environment and becomes part of, you know, our drinking water supply in many cases.
So that's a big one, is getting used to the idea that we should be wearing natural fabrics that are not shedding these microfibers or little pieces of microplastics.
What about things like fleeces and so on?
All of them. They're all synthetics.
So every time you wash them, you're throwing...
Absolutely.
You're getting fibers
Absolutely.
Into the wastewater.
You know, they do make these little bags that are very, very finely woven that you can put your synthetic clothing in.
To wash it?
To wash it, that, you know, that keeps the fibers inside the bag. I know. I mean, this is where we've come, right?
Jeez Louise.
But you can do that. There is a company that makes them. The best thing to do is to just purchase just natural fibers: cotton, linen, wool, bamboo. It's, you know, they're using a lot of bamboo for making fabrics today, mm-hmm. and those things do not shed microplastics, obviously, because they're not plastic.
So it's the clothing. It's washing the clothes.
Right. Right. And, you know, at the end of the day, your household upholstery and your carpeting and so on, if it's not wool and if it's not, you know, made from linen or another natural fiber, is going to wind up in a landfill. Or, you know, if you wash them, it's going to do the same thing as your clothing, which is to shed these microfibers.
Or probably if you just walk on it and
you walk
use
on it. Yeah, and I was going to say, children, you know, who are so close to the ground, I mean, you know, they're playing all the time on these synthetic carpets and they disturb the fibers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so some of them obviously are released into the air close to the ground where children are breathing.
What about your vacuum? Do you need a HEPA vacuum?
Yeah, the HEPA vacuum cleaner is better because it does capture, you know, more of these tiny little particles, mm-hmm. which, and HEPA filters were primarily made for people who are, you know, allergic. Mm-hmm. They're a good thing. They also do something to reduce the amount of microfibers. But the indoor air quality, when you have a lot of synthetics for your decorating inside your home, it's, you know, you're asking for trouble. I mean, you're really asking for trouble. And indoor air quality is way more problematic than outdoor air quality.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Patty.
You're welcome.
If you have an environmental question for Patty, anything from cleaning products to water filters to air fresheners to dry cleaning to paint, carpeting, baby furniture, wireless radiation, whatever it is, drop us a line at greenstreetradio.com. That's going to do it for our show today. Special thanks to our guest, Kyla Bennett, our engineers, Scott Person and Michael G. Haskins, and all the other people at WBAI who keep this remarkable station on the air. Patty and I will be back next week with another edition of Green Street. Until then, be safe, be well. See you next time.
This is Julian Assange. You're listening to WBAI New York. Stay strong and keep listening.
The 2021 local station board elections are underway. Two parallel, separate elections amongst listener and staff members are electing 9 and 3 members, respectively, to be seated on the local station board. Need help deciding who to vote for to represent you on the local station board? Visit elections.pacifica.org for links to audio and video materials, including candidate statements, forums, and debates. There you can file a ballot request to get a copy of your ballot or even reset your vote if you made a mistake. Members without access to the internet can call 510-993-0320 to leave a message for the election supervisor. Paper ballot replacements will be issued through October 1st. All ballots must be received by October 15th, 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time to be counted.
Don't tell me to stop. Tell the rain not to drop. Tell me everything I'm not. Don't tell me to stop.
Hi, this is Liz Wright. You're listening to WBAI in New York.
This is Dr. James McIntosh, host of Mindfield, which comes to you every Wednesday at 2 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM. Together with my co-host, nurse, family therapist, Richardina Theodore, we delve into the explosive issues in mental health. Our mission is to help you know yourself, release your anxieties and your depression, and free your mind. Only on WBAI, the voice of the voiceless, can we voiceless ones be heard. Support the show and WBAI by donating at give2.org.
WBAI.org. That's the word give, the number 2, at WBAI.org. Or by calling 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. You can support the show and the station even more by going to give2wbai.org and giving a monthly donation of as little as $10 per month as a WBAI buddy to your favorite show on WBAI 99.5 FM.
Hi, this is Iggy Pop, and you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth.
Hi, this is Joe Strummer, and you're listening to WBAI, and it's all mixed up, and it's mixed in, too.
Okay.
WBAI New York at 99.5 FM, WBAI.org, on the web. The next local station board candidate statements can be heard at 11:55. So stay tuned for that. Some extraordinary program, that is to say programming, is coming your way next over WBAI.